Chapter 1
"And that's how Johann saved the Princess Marja from the evil wizard," said the old farmer.
"Uh-huh,"
said the warrior, without looking up from the long scroll of parchment in his hand.
"And she married good Prince Handor, who's King Handor now, long live his majesty."
The farmer was as gnarled and leathery as the turnips strewn around his field. He was the sort of rural soul who had more fingers than teeth. And he was missing several fingers.
"I think we're all familiar with the story of Johann," said the warrior, marking his document with a weathered quill. He was a pot-bellied man, covered in furs and scraps of armor.
"Didn't ask for nothing in return, neither," said the farmer.
"He got a rather large estate in Andoran, as I recall."
The farmer got a sly look in his good eye.
"Ah, but he didn't ask for it, see? 'Cause he was a true hero."
"Well, I'm a professional one. Just pay your bill, sir."
The farmer snorted and gestured to the turnips haphazardly scattered around him.
"You and your so-called professionals tore up half my fields."
"In pursuit of the reported goblin threat," said the hero.
He made another mark on the document.
"You burned down my barn, flushing the varmints out."
The farmer pointed his three-fingered hand at a pile of smoldering beams and charred hay.
"Where's the sense in that?"
"I'm afraid it doesn't matter if it makes sense," said the warrior. "It's standard procedure."
"But you broke all my barrels."
"Standard procedure."
The farmer was aghast.
"You looted my basement."
The hero shrugged.
"Standard procedure."
But.
The farmer grasped the hero's arm and spoke in a low whisper.
"But you and my daughter."
The nervous tittering of an infatuated young woman rang out from within the ramshackle farmhouse. A hint of a smile twitched at the warrior's mouth.
"Standard procedure," he quipped.
"But you can't... you..."
The farmer reeled uncertainly.
"Sir, you put out a contract to exterminate a nest of goblins," said the warrior, brandishing his document.
The contract was written in exquisite script, and near the bottom of the page the hero had checked off and initialed a number of tasks. Below that, the farmer's signature was scrawled among several others, surrounded by official seals and stamps.
"The good people at Adventure Capital Incorporated accepted your contract and hired me and my associates to kill said goblins and outfitted us with the gear necessary to do so. Now that the goblins are dead, I'm afraid it's a little late to decide you don't like the terms of your contract." The
farmer shook his head and stared out at his ravaged fields. The ground was littered with green corpses and ruined crops.
"I thought the loot would pay your fee. Thought there'd be some left over for me, too. Heard that's how a man can get rich nowadays. Find some foes, claim the contract, get a cut of the loot. Barton Mander had a griffin take his cow, and he bought himself 3 acres with his cut of the hoard."
He turned back to the hero, his eyes filling with tears and futile rage.
"And then you come in. You ruin my farm, you take all the food in my stores, and you tell me that's the loot. You rob me, give me half my stuff back, and charge me for it."
"No, the goblins in your basement
robbed you," corrected the warrior. "We took it from them. That's what loot is."
"It came from my house!"
"Where else do you think loot comes from?" hollered the hero, finally losing patience with the old man.
The farmer didn't have a ready answer, but he was spared the trouble of finding one by a high-pitched scream. A lone goblin, presumably startled by the warrior's shout, burst from its hiding place in the charred ruins of the barn. Once the creature's huge, panicked eyes caught sight of the warrior, it took off, sprinting in the opposite direction, clouds of soot billowing in its trail.
"Bones!" swore the warrior.
"Oh!"
The farmer pointed to the hero and then to the fleeing goblin, and then back to the hero again.
"You ain't done! You ain't got 'em all! I ain't paying!"
"Sir," the hero tried, "the goblins are all dead or dispersed. One or two stragglers—"
"Contract says exterminate!"
said the farmer, practically dancing.
"You ain't done!"
"It doesn't make sense to chase down every single goblin," protested the warrior. "They're harmless alone."
The old farmer's malicious grin displayed his limited collection of teeth.
"Don't have to make sense. Do it," he cackled. "It's standard procedure."
There was no recourse for the hero. Fuming and sputtering curses, he hiked his belt up, tucked the contract into his rucksack, adjusted a couple of armor plates, and set off at a brisk trot after the goblin. Goblins do not excel at much, but they are masters at tactical retreat. This particular goblin was talented enough at fleeing that it took the hero more than an hour of tracking before he even had the creature in his sights. The goblin led him off the old man's farm, down a stream, through some scrubwood, and to the main road from Mistkeep to Anduin. The warrior had to chase it for a further mile down the road until both were well past the point of stumbling exhaustion. Finally, the warrior was close enough to make a desperate swipe with his sword. The goblin made an equally desperate attempt to dodge it. The maneuver sent the creature tumbling into a muddy ditch on the roadside, the warrior barreling after it. The hero raised his sword for the final blow. The goblin fell backward onto a pile of mud and leaves, which immediately startled both combatants by sitting bolt upright and roaring like a demon. Goblins are famously unsavory creatures. A goblin's skin is pale green and oily, and reeks even when it's clean, which is almost never. Their large yellow eyes constantly run, their mouths bristle with serrated teeth, and their stunted piggy noses are always dribbling something disgusting. Like a bad hangover, a goblin can make any experience much more unpleasant. Gorm Ingerson had the misfortune to discover new depths of displeasure when he awoke to a goblin and a bad hangover combined. The creature was clamoring over his face, and the dull, throbbing sobriety thundered in his skull with such fury that he sat up with a start and screamed. His shout startled the goblin into screaming, too, which scared the fat human enough to cause him to fall on his rear. Consequently, for a time, the three of them sat shrieking at each other in confusion.
"What are you doing here?"
hollered the fat man, pointing his sword at Gorm and the goblin in turn.
"Keep it down," growled Gorm, gripping his forehead. "I was sleeping it off before it jumped back on again."
His initial surprise was receding, but a dull pain was washing in to replace it. Gorm stood with slow, labored movements and tried to remember how much he had drunk. Last night was a blur. This morning was a smear.
"You're a dwarf!" exclaimed the fat man. "What tipped you off, the beard?"
"Oh, I couldn't see that under all the leaves and muck," said the man, pointing at detritus that covered the dwarf from head to toe.
"It's just that you're really—"
The warrior trailed off. Gorm and the warrior stared at the warrior's hand, held level with the dwarf's head at about chest height.
"Aye?"
Gorm said softly. Some would say dwarves are sensitive about their height, but not when dwarves are within earshot. It would be more accurate, and much safer, to say they enjoy vigorously defying stereotypes about height and prowess.
"Speaking with a thick accent," finished the warrior.
"Ha, right," said Gorm, realizing that the human looked like a professional hero.
His mismatched armor had clearly been scavenged from a variety of foes, and his sword showed a faint glimmer of magic around its edges, probably somewhere around the third rank.
"You on a run?"
The rank three warrior's demeanor warmed at Gorm's use of heroic jargon.
"That I am," he said. "You a hero, then?" "Oh, I've done my fair share of quests and grinds. Used to be a big name in the guild. Still am in some circles."
This was true, strictly speaking. Specifically, the Heroes Guild's internal affairs and enforcement departments maintained a keen interest in Gorm.
"What's the job?"
"I'm harvesting greenskins for the points." Gorm gave a short laugh and pulled a clump of leaves from his long, rusty beard.
"Well, you don't take 'em for the loot, right?"
"Right," guffawed Rank Three. "Not the best job I've had."
"Well, you take what comes."
Opportunism was the mark of a professional adventurer. When a potential payout passed a hero's way, he was either ready or missed out. Gorm had spent too many nights clutching an empty belly to let a chance for a quick bit of gold pass him by, even if he was hungover and covered in mud.
"Quite right. If you'll excuse me, there's just one left," said Rank Three, with a nod to the goblin.
The wretched creature was lame with exhaustion, crawling on its belly away from the two men. When it realized it was being watched, it squealed piteously and doubled its futile effort at escape.
"This won't take but a moment," said the hero, cleaning his sword. It was a nice-looking sword, at least twice enchanted. Valuable.
"But here's a thought," said Gorm pointedly, pulling another clump of filth from his beard. "Why not let the little blighter live and just say you killed it? All of the benefits, none of the risk. Very economical, see?"
"It's the nature of being a professional hero," Rank Three shrugged. Gorm could hear the warrior's purse jingling. "Fight, kill, loot, get credit, repeat until you're dead," said the hero.
"See, I just skip the fightin' and killin' and forego the credit," said Gorm. "Instead, I give the target a chance to hand over the loot."
Rank Three took off his helmet, which was easily worth 40 gilton, to scratch his head.
"I don't see how that benefits you."
Gorm smiled.
"I'd say you'll benefit more than I will.
Eh?
This here is your chance."
Realization spread over Rank Three's face, quickly giving way to anger.
"That sounded like a threat," he growled.
"More of an offer."
Gorm pulled his old axe from the mud. It was a simple wedge of iron on a solid oak shaft wrapped in grimy leather straps. Old and plain, and not the least bit magical, it was, however, dwarven made, which meant it was balanced and sharp. Gorm didn't need much else.
"I got a feeling I'm about to find a stash of loot. Doesn't make a difference to me if I find it on the ground or on your corpse."
"Sagich?"
asked the goblin. The warrior's eyes narrowed.
"Dwarf, I don't want to fight you."
"No, you don't,"
agreed Gorm. He could see the warrior sizing him up, trying to gauge his rank. On the whole, professional heroes are remarkably prone to violence, and this is by necessity. A hero's work consists almost exclusively of forcibly separating deadly monsters and nefarious villains from their valuables. A long history of armed conflict had shaped the Heroes Guild into a group that was remarkably effective at killing and remarkably poor at conflict resolution. Professional versus professional combat remained an ever-present threat to up-and-coming adventurers, especially those who couldn't quickly determine whether or not they were outmatched.
"Do yourself a favor, lad," Gorm said, nudging the warrior in the right direction. "Lose the gear and gold, specifically where I can find it."
Instead, Rank Three opted to call the bluff Gorm wasn't making. Red-faced and spraying spittle, he charged forward with an angry bellow. A good charge is a hard thing to appreciate. Most people assume anyone can grab a weapon and run straight at an enemy, pointy end forward, and for the most part they're correct. The tricky part of a frontal assault, Gorm knew, was surviving it. But if you had the finesse, timing, and skill, a good charge could be unexpectedly effective. A sloppy charge, on the other hand, is easily countered. A feint to the left, a quick knee to the gut, perhaps an elbow to the nose for emphasis, and a swift uppercut could leave an inexperienced assailant flying through the air with blood and surprise all over his face. Theoretically, anyway. In practice, it took a second uppercut. Gorm took a moment to retrieve Rank Three's fallen sword before strolling over to where the warrior had landed.
"You're no hero," the wounded warrior gasped, struggling for as much breath as a broken nose and bruised sternum would allow.
You're a common thief."
"I still ain't found the difference," said Gorm. "Second chance, lad. You won't get a third."
As luck would have it, Rank Three had found time to reconsider the attachment to material possessions that had overtaken his life and had recently threatened to end it. He departed shortly thereafter, with a renewed appreciation for existence, his undergarments, and little else, leaving Gorm to take inventory of his recent find. The warrior's purse contained over 40 gilton in loose coin, plus another 80 in banknotes and guild checks. Much of the armor was worthless, leathers so old and furs so thin that a tanner wouldn't buy them for scrap. Still, the iron helmet was sturdy enough to fetch a decent price, as were a steel pauldron and a pair of chain greaves, and the sword alone was worth at least 100. Bundled with a couple of rings, some hard provisions, and a sturdy belt of elven make, Gorm estimated the hero had been carrying well over 400 gilton worth of goods and gear, and perhaps best of all, a salt pork sandwich for lunch. He was cleaning crumbs of crusty bread and bits of grease from his whiskers when a small voice piped up from the edge of the woods.
"Gleebeck?"
it chirped. Gorm looked up from his recent haul. The goblin was crouched at the edge of the woods, eyeing him with optimistic caution.
Gleebuck,
it said, tapping its ribcage with a bony fist.
Gleebuck!
Gorm snorted.
Oh, thought you'd run off. Probably should have.
He turned back to organizing his new armor by weight and value.
Gleebuck! Dagob Tibrin! Rel Lubbins de Poots!
The goblin tapped its chest.
Look, Gleebuck!
Gleebuck!
Aye, or whatever you call yourself, Gorm said without looking up. I know it must have looked like I saved your hide, but really I was just liberating these here valuables. It's your lucky day that I ain't got no reason to kill you, but I ain't got a reason not to either, so you'd best leave before my mood changes.
The threat in Gorm's voice was strong enough to leap over the language barrier. The goblin's face flashed with panic, and it swiftly retreated back into the woods. But it didn't leave. Gorm caught glimpses of a nervous green face peering at him from the trees as he bundled up the goods. When he took a bath in a nearby brook, he could hear something splashing around downstream. Something small and furtive had darted through the woods and startled the wandering tinker who bought the stolen weapons and armor. And Gorm heard a few people claim they saw a goblin skulking outside the roadside tavern where he spent most of the day's earnings on enough alcohol to drown his memories and give them a proper burial at sea. The next morning he awoke in a different part of the Freedlands, lying face down in a different ditch, with different mud smeared through his beard, and the same goblin crouched a few yards away, staring at him with big amber eyes. The wretched creature even followed Gorm after breakfast, as he wandered the road from Mistkeep to Whitegeld, and hid in the trees 100 yards behind him. It got closer when Gorm settled down for lunch, and it was following within a couple of arms' length by the afternoon. No amount of hollering or threats would keep it away for long. For a while, Gorm thought about putting the goblin out of his misery. Gorm's, not the goblin's, but the idea didn't settle well in his gut. There was no money in it. And gods knew the points wouldn't do Gorm any good. Mostly he didn't like the taste of killing someone or something just for being too friendly. He'd have much preferred to scare it off. Later that evening, sitting by a makeshift fire and swigging cheap rum, Gorm realized it would be difficult to scare off a goblin when he was probably the least threatening thing the goblin could encounter. Heroics was an increasingly popular profession. Despite the low base pay, poor benefits, and a mortality rate that made working in a gnomish foundry look like an office job, there was no shortage of men and women lining up to wield a blade and delve into some ancient dungeon in search of fame and fortune, not necessarily in that order. To get into an ancient dungeon, however, a hero needed to be of sufficient rank. Rank 10 heroes regularly struck down eldritch horrors for bags of gold. But a rank 1 hero was lucky to clean a basement of uncommonly nasty rats for a handful of gilton. The only way to gain ranks was to get points on your hero's license. The fastest way to get points on a license was to kill things that the Heroes Guild had designated as foes, or more accurately, FOEs, forces of evil. To any of the multitude of young up-and-coming professional heroes wandering the Freedlands, a wild goblin was a walking professional advancement just waiting to be skewered. The goblin had to choose between a forest full of professional goblin killers and a surly dwarf whom he had seen fighting one of them. The fact that Gorm was even thinking about the goblin, instead of cleaning it off his axe, put him leagues ahead of any other choice. Gorm was the best of bad options.
"More the pity for you,"
slurred Gorm, raising his bottle to the goblin crouched opposite the fire pit.
"It don't go well for folks who pin their hopes on me."
"Nab Guggins?"
"Better off on your own,"
said Gorm, but even in the depths of his inebriation he knew that wasn't true. It would be an understatement to say that goblins are family-oriented. They have breeding habits that would make a rabbit blush, enshrined in a culture that valued a large family over any other virtue. The Anthropological Society of Scoria theorized that goblin culture was steeped in procreation because they were bred to be the shock troops of the armies of evil in ages long past. To this day, strength in numbers remains a goblin tribe's most viable defense. Goblins don't live alone, at least not for very long. This particular goblin had undoubtedly been blessed with a large family before a group of adventurers made short work of them, leaving it alone and frightened.
It reminded Gorm of when he'd heard the sentence handed down, and the great gates of Khazad-dûm had closed to him forever, leaving him standing in the cold damp of the pine fells, wondering how he would live without his brothers and uncles and clansmen, where he would live, how he could work, how he could eat. Gorm took a swig of rum as the unwelcome memory surfaced. It didn't work.
Liebeck.
Liebeck?
Here.
Gorm tossed a hard biscuit to the goblin. Then he bundled up his provisions and lay down, using his pack for a pillow. He was sick of drinking, and sick of being sober, and regretting that those were essentially the only two options he, and everyone else, ever had. Above him, sparks from the fire danced up toward the leaves of oaks and birches, cavorting in a summer breeze that smelled sweet and smoky. Beyond the trees, the stars glimmered around a gibbous moon. He listened to the crickets and the breeze and the frenetic scarfing sounds of a goblin attempting to inhale a hard biscuit. Gorm didn't see any good options. He could leave the goblin to its fate, but this had proved more difficult than anticipated in the past, and he knew what the fates held for a lone goblin in the span. Or he could take the goblin with him, but if the little blighter wanted to avoid trouble with the Heroes Guild, it would be best not to be within a wide radius of Gorm. The only option left was to take the goblin to Andoran to get its non-combatant papers. With those in hand, a goblin could walk the streets in relative safety, provided it kept its head down. Gorm was a proponent of keeping one's head down. Unfortunately, that was why he usually avoided Andoran. Still, the Freedland's capital was a big city, and he'd been there before without any trouble he hadn't been looking for. And a set of papers could be acquired within a day. If he timed it right, he wouldn't even need to spend a night in the city. It was a small thing, really, Gorm thought. A tiny kindness for a goblin nobody would give a second thought to. Totally inconsequential. He'd have forgotten he'd even done it by this time next year, if not next month. Gorm made his decision. History pivoted on it. Deshman Scroot enjoyed his job. He saw interesting things at work. He met interesting people. Most importantly, he was the big man in the room, and not just because he was the only man in his department who wasn't some variety of gnome.
"That will go on Lot A, Mr. Muggins," he said to a halfling who was struggling under the weight of a massive claymore.
"Yes, Mr. Scroot. And tell the Tinderkin I want to see the half-plate properly polished."
"Yes, sir."
Scroot walked through the airy warehouse, festooned with long cerulean banners that featured a sword crossed by a flaming comet, sword and sorcery being the ancient crest of the Heroes Guild. The room was divided into lots, each rapidly filling with weapons, armor, jewelry, gems, and sacks of gold. Any professional hero will tell you that the most important step of any quest, big or small, is dividing the loot. The hero's business model is based on the principle that ancient and powerful evils also tend to be wealthy ones, due to the fact that the foe have spent so long pillaging the countryside and slaying well-equipped heroes. Thus the old axiom, the bigger they are, the richer will be. Of course, a monster's killers aren't the only ones with claims on its loot. A quest giver, be it a simple shepherd or an entire city, could lay claim to 9/10 of a hoard, minus the hero's fee. And quest givers could often capitalize on those claims by selling shares of the hoard, even before the foe in possession of the loot had been slain. The speculators who bought those shares often bundled them into plunder funds, which were then divided up and sold to other companies, who were owned by other companies, and beyond that, well, it hurt Scroot's head to think about who owned what. Fortunately, the shares owned by each interested party were always written down for him. Scroot glanced at his clipboard as he made his way up the stairs to the catwalk. The city of Scoria, 26%. Adventure Capital, 13%. The heroes, led by one Arthan the Brightblade, got 10% plus a 6,000 gilton fee. The White Geld Bannermen Pension Fund, 8%. Relic Investment Group, 3%. Goldson Bag's High-Risk Adventuring Fund, 1%. Goldson Bag's Ironbreaker's Hoard Fund, 0.5%. Scroot stopped reading. The rest of the list was all plunder funds. As far as Scroot was concerned, percentages were the easy part. Dividing loot always boiled down to the same question, who gets what?
After all, a ring of safeguarding and a conch of the sea were technically worth the same amount, but it was a lot easier to sell warriors a ring that surrounded a wearer in a magical shield than a big shell that could summon fish. Larger hordes often had so much treasure and so many interested parties that the loot couldn't be divided without guild intervention. That was where Scroot stepped in. Scroot stepped into the warehouse office.
"Arbiter Scroot! Arbiter Scroot! Sir, I must insist!"
Scroot walked calmly through the crowd of shouting representatives and heroes, all clamoring for his attention. He didn't hurry as he made his way around the long oak table in the middle of the room to the great windows at the rear of the office. Folding his hands behind his back, he wordlessly stared out the window at the work below. It looked like a good hoard. Heaps of treasure and gear filled every lot from A to H. Most of the gold wasn't even gilton, but old solid gold coins from before the turn of the age. You didn't find those often anymore, not even amid the peaks of the iron breakers. Apparently it had been an ancient wyvern. Scroot could see a team of hill gnomes hauling the long reptilian carcass in. The head would wind up on the wall of some tavern. The talons and venom sac would be sold to the elves for medicinal purposes. The hide would be valuable to high-end armorsmiths, and the meat could be fed to dogs or orphans. By the time the wyvern was on the butcher's block, silence had fallen in the room behind him. Scroot turned to find a cadre of indistinguishable business people, representing various companies, seated around the table, all forcing polite smiles. The full party of five guild heroes was also present, including a diminutive scribkin wizard and a rather fetching cleric of Musana. Scroot smoothed his mustache and sat at the table.
"Now then," he said, "let's begin."
One by one, treasures were carried in by the attendants and placed on a dais near the door, along with an initial appraisal. More often than not, the men and women around the table agreed to the estimates without comment, each noting the items that they would most like to procure. Some finds, however, were more contentious, such as a small black statue of a puma.
"This sculpture will apparently summon a celestial war cat from the metaphysical planes," Scroot read from a card.
"What can you make the cat do?"
asked the party's warrior, a burly man in a horned helm.
"Let me see," said Scroot, checking a scrawled note in the margin. "Ah, nothing. It is, after all, a cat. Still, it is valued at 10,000 gilden."
The sum prompted protests from the warrior, but was defended by the representatives from Adventure Capital. They bickered and argued and debated for a while, until Mr. Scroot weighed in with a suggested price of 9,000 gilden, and all agreed. The next item was brought in. The process could take days. Scroot surmised the treasure from this hoard would take a week just to assess. Actually dividing and distributing the loot would likely take another month. The cleric and the wizard were eyeing the same amulet. Just after Scroot returned from his lunch break, the marble busts were wheeled in. There were five of them in the display case, each about a hand's length to a foot in height, milky white with orange stains running down their surface. They were carved into heads with angled, exaggerated features. Time and weather had worn away much of the detail, but one could still make out tiny eyes, sloped brows, and square jaws with tusked underbites. Scroot didn't have time to glance at the stone's card before one of the businessmen spoke up.
"Excuse me, Arbiter Scroot, these will be sent to Relic Investments in Andoran." "That remains to be seen, I believe," said Scroot.
"No, it does not." The speaker was a thin human with a dark suit and a pair of silver spectacles. His name plaque identified him as Mr. Boggart. He looked almost exactly like Scroot, with perhaps a little more gray in his hair. An uncanny resemblance, really.
"Relic Investments will forfeit any other claim on this hoard," Mr. Boggart added.
The other stakeholders seemed more confused than upset by the proclamation. Aside from being unorthodox, it was just bad business. They'd seen over 300,000 gilden in treasures so far today, and there was coin worth over 500,000. Whatever secret the stones held, it wasn't worth a 3% stake in such a hoard. Still, whether or not it was good business was someone else's problem. Scroot's concern was procedural.
"It is my job to arbitrate and decide how this loot is divided, Mr. Boggart, and I shall do so only after it is all accounted for."
Mr. Boggart's companion leaned forward.
He was an exceptionally unattractive specimen, with a face like a gnarled oak and a single bulging eye. His neatly cropped hair, rumpled suit, and conspicuous eye patch were all the same shade of gray. He had no name plaque.
"That won't be necessary,"
he said, pointing to the card in Mr. Scroot's hand. Scroot glanced down. The card read, in large type, "Lot B, items 782 to 786. These items shall be the property of Relic Investment Group, Incorporated, hereafter Relic Investments. Any other claim owned by Relic Investments to the hoard of the Wyvern of Dark Crag Mountain is hereby forfeit." Aside from that, there was nothing on the card except for the seal of the Office of the High Arbiter. It was unorthodox and unprecedented, but the High Arbiter wasn't constrained by orthodoxy or precedence.
"Ah," said Mr. Scroot, "it seems the matter is settled, then."
"Yes," agreed Mr. Boggart, standing. "Thank you, and good day."
"A pleasure,"
added the one-eyed man. They walked out of the room. The case of stones was wheeled out after them. A double-headed great axe was carried in. The assessment resumed. Later, Scroot stood in the office window, observing the floor during a coffee break. He watched the team of hill gnomes load 5 small crates onto a carriage bearing the Heroes Guild crest, while Mr. Boggart climbed aboard it. Scroot saw the carriage leave the loading bay and take a turn on the road south. Then he turned back to the meeting, and he didn't give the stones or the carriage another thought until a week later, when guild investigators told him that both the carriage and the cart had disappeared somewhere along the road to Andoran.